Focus on the Family on AM 1230 KPRL and 99.3 FM is brought to you by Sculptera Winery and Sculpture Garden. The Frankel family and staff invite you to visit their beautiful world and taste their award-winning estate wine. Open daily 10 to 5 on Lanay Road in Paso Robles.
And I literally have a piece of paper in my office that says, here are the big rocks.
Jessica Smart on Focus on the Family Minute, sharing about having the right priorities as a parent.
Love the Lord. Be a good daughter. Raise your kids. Be a good wife. Spend time with God. Keep my body healthy. Those are the big rocks. And then the smaller rocks are all of those other bonuses that I can fit in if I have the margin and the bandwidth. And so my clarion call, I hope, to moms is that all these things we're putting on ourselves, especially the young moms. When you are a young mom, sometimes it is all you can do to just raise babies. And it feels like such a long period of time, but it is not. You know, we have the rest of our lives to do those big dreams and do the traveling and whatever. It's just such a short period of time that we have little ones in the home.
More insights from Jessica Smart today when you visit FamilyMinute.org.
Focus on the Family on AM 1230 KPRL and 99.3 FM is brought to you by Sculptera Winery and Sculpture Garden. The Frankel family and staff invite you to visit their beautiful world and taste their award-winning estate wine. Open daily 10 to 5 on Lanay Road in Paso Robles.
Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story, brought to you by Frontier Floors and Window Coverings at 830 21st Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-7878 or online at frontierfloors.net.
Now, the rest of the story. One June morning, Tom awakened feeling very strange. He got out of bed, he looked in the mirror, and gasped in horror. The right side of his chest and his right shoulder seemed to have collapsed. Even the corresponding area of his back appeared to have caved in. There was some paralysis and no muscle tone at all, as though an entire section of the young man's body had simply deflated. Tom had a construction job that summer, but there was no way that he was going to work that morning. Instead, he got dressed, hurried to see his athletic trainer at Texas A&M. The trainer shrugged, sent Tom to a doctor. The doctor shrugged, sent Tom to another doctor, one at Houston Medical Center. There were tests and x-rays, and finally, a diagnosis. A spinal disc in Tom's neck was herniated. It was blocking nervous function on the right side. Virtually no circulation was reaching his right chest or shoulder or back. Now the pain was intense. So Tom did not hesitate to consent when the doctor recommended immediate surgery. But this is the rest of the story. Tom was on the football team at Texas A&M. He loved the game. So the first thing when Tom was coming out from under the anesthetic, he asked the surgeon, "Can I still play?" The doctor was grim. The injury to Tom's neck, doubtless football-related, had been repaired by the operation for now. And yet further injury could result in much worse, even permanent damage. For the sake of avoiding such a calamity, Tom must never play football again. Well, the surgery was July 14. After 10 days in the hospital, Tom was released. And all summer, his upper body remained deformed, the right side still appearing to have caved in. His fourth year at A&M, Tom attended classes, but he was out of football. He was on redshirt, as it was called. And after 6 months of shaking his head in the mirror, Tom decided to rebuild his misshapen right side. He tried weights. The awful pain stopped him. More months passed. Gradually, Tom began to tolerate workouts. Ever so slowly, his chest and his shoulder and his back began to return to their proper proportions. Tom would attend A&M one more year. If only he could get well enough and strong enough to play football. He went to another doctor at Houston Medical Center, a specialist theretofore unfamiliar with the case. And to this physician, he related a lifelong dream. Ever since Tom could remember, his greatest desire was to play football in college, to play well enough to be drafted into the NFL. It didn't matter which team drafted him, nor what kind of a career he was going to have thereafter. Tom just wanted to be good enough to play big-time ball someday. Well, the doctor was sympathetic, but the risk was tremendous. Spurring had already occurred around the spinal nerves in Tom's neck. Another injury could prove disastrous. But it was Tom's life. It was his choice. If he felt he had to play football and that the risk was worth it, the doctor would not stand in his way. To Tom, the risk was worth it. He was not going to spend the rest of his life on redshirt if he could possibly help it. And so, despite the pain and the apprehension, Tom resumed college football. he would have one last year to make his dream come true. Well, the record shows that prior to his 1985 Super Bowl season, Coach Mike Ditka of Chicago's Bears drafted a running back out of Texas A&M, a young man named Thomas Sanders. And over the four seasons since, that gifted player's superlative performance has spoken most eloquently for itself. Coach Ditka has said that he chose Tom Sanders mainly because of something intangible, something called attitude. Now you know what Mike meant, because now you know the rest of the story.
This hour of Sound Off on KPRL brought to you by Slow Heating and Air, your local reliable heating and air expert. Call 805-423-5119.
238-5775. 238-KPRL. Sound Off continues on KPRL, the North County's number one choice for news, talk, and sports. This is Sound Off on The Right Choice, KPRL.
Welcome back to Sound Off. My name is Karen Vealy, your host on Wednesday and Thursday afternoons. I'm also an investigative reporter with Cal Coast News. We just posted a story today. Videos depict violent beating of homeless man in Arroyo Grande. We did requests and received videos that the students made, or the two young men that hunted down and beat the homeless man made themselves, and what they were saying, why they were beating him. We also have the security videos that were taken by the city of Arroyo Grande. One of the big issues here is these are two young men that it's surprising that the victim did not die. He has serious, he had traumatic brain injury. He still has trouble remembering names. He has constant headaches. He was seriously damaged by these two young men. In the end, the district attorney wanted 7 years. Probation recommended 1 year in jail and 5 years of probation. And the judge went with that recommendation. I recommend you read the story and look at what is happening with some of the some of the new rules with jail sentences. Today I have Dan Blackburn on the show. He's a co-founder of Cal Coast News. 36 years ago, he wrote a best-selling book, Human Harvest, about serial killer Dorothy Puentes. Who buried, they believe that she killed approximately 9 people and then buried some of them in her backyard. 9 people who she was collecting their Social Security for. And Dan Blackburn was talking to her while she was in jail and wrote a great book on that. In the middle of all this, what we were talking about at the end of the first half hour was that the defense attorneys wanted information from Dan Blackburn, and we were talking about what legal route they took to try to get him to give it to you. Dan, will you go back to telling us how this went down?
Absolutely. As I said, the defense thought that the tapes that I had would be beneficial to prove their point that Dorothea had expressed her innocence in a earlier forum where she had no reason to be lying, or et cetera, et cetera. That was their contention. So one day I received this subpoena which said I should report to Sacramento court, and the purpose of that was essentially to try to get the information that the defense team wanted from me. I was kind of naive in those days, and I said, I'm not going to go to Sacramento. Scrum. But fortunately for me, right across the alley from where I lived was a wonderful attorney named John Blood. I loved his name, and he did too. John said to me, Dan, you've got to answer the subpoena, otherwise they'll come and get you. I said, no, I don't know if I want to go. And he said, come on, you pay my airfare, give me a hotel room, buy me dinner, maybe a drink or two, I'll represent you. So we did that. We went to Sacramento. And it was I didn't realize it going up there, but it was a big deal. The press was all over this big court hearing. I mean, there were four or five television cameras. In those days, you could do cameras and other stuff in the courtroom if the judge approved. Still do, I guess. But anyway, it was all of a sudden a big deal. My attorney, John, talks to Kevin Climo and the rest of Kevin's team, and then came back over to me, and he said, you're lucky I'm representing you. They were talking about carving you a new one. And I said, uh-oh. Yes. He said, yeah, they want to pursue the fact that you illegally obtained these texts, these tapes, and that alone should make them available to the defense. So basically what occurred was a full-blown hearing, and I don't remember any of the details. I didn't testify about whether or not I had access to the California Reporters' Shield Law. Climo was arguing that I did not have that shield because I wasn't working for an established media entity, that I was instead an independent contractor working with a publisher. So therefore, I wasn't a reporter under the definition of California law. As I sat in the courtroom, I, of course, realized that I was about to hear something about whether or not I was what I thought I was, a journalist. So when the time came, the judge asked me to stand up. I was out in the middle of the courtroom somewhere, and I stood up, and I heard these cameras all start whirring, and my heart was just hammering. And I remember the judge saying, Mr. Blackburn's professional history indicates to me that he is a professional journalist, whether he's working for a news entity or not. And that was the end of the hearing. As a result of that, I'm actually the only adjudicated journalist in the state of California. I don't think the situation's ever come up where a California judge had to decide whether or not a reporter had that shield law and was, in fact, a journalist or not a journalist. So, anyway, that was kind of a remarkable moment in my life, and I didn't realize until afterwards how close I had come to encountering a really serious issue. As it was, we kind of slid out of it. I made a comment or two to the press, and I couldn't really talk about it, and we flew home, and it was over. But I got a lot of respect at that point, I think, for the power of the courts, because a lot could have happened to me had I not listened to my friend, John, the lawyer. So that was what occurred with that. Once behind. And it makes an interesting story, but it really doesn't detract too much from what Dorothea really was, which was somebody who exploited the system, which took 13 years to repair after my book. 13 years.
Can I ask you, one of the things that your book did, and I read your book years ago, it kind of detailed how she got where she was going, what made her do this, and what she did. Can you kind of track the events in her life that led to this?
Sure. The evidence showed at trial that she was kind of a con person from many, many years back. She would marry men, exploit their finances, and divorce them. She did that on several occasions. At least she didn't kill any of them. They were all shown to be alive during trial. But so she was basically learning how to do stuff that was illegal. And the interesting part of it is, when I met her, and, inquired around about her, and, again, no huge reason to be terribly interested in Dorothea at that particular time. But she was pretty well thought of in the community, particularly by those who cared, police officers, parole agents, anybody who dealt with her. because she was doing something that seemed to be really good for the community. She was taking care of these people. And these people were her tenants who, you know, were very quick to say what how great the food was, you know, and how happy they were because essentially they were happy until some of them weren't there anymore. She had, as I say, a number of divorces that she was able to exploit. So in the meantime, as all that was occurring over a number of years, she learned how government benefits worked, particularly after a beneficiary died. So she came into her later middle-aged years armed with a great amount of knowledge. Apparently, this was testimony, a great amount of knowledge about how the Social Security system worked and where the gaps were that she could exploit. And as I said, she was considered to be in the community, you know, an up-and-comer, a real good one of the good people. I recall one incident. I was sitting in Henry's having a cocktail. I was the boss at the time, so I could do that. And it was early afternoon, maybe 2 or 3 o'clock. And Dorothea came in and immediately bought a round for the house, saw me, came down and sat down. I don't know, we chit-chatted a bit. I don't remember what we talked about. But she pulled out this thing out of her purse. It was a bunch of papers. While she was asking me, you know, I got a favor to ask. I'll make it worth your while. I'm trying to take care of some sort of business, you know, internally with her house. Wondered if I would sign one of these documents with the name of one of her tenants. I looked at her and kind of chuckled. So I said, of course not. So she immediately put everything back and put it away. And it's interesting. She had asked me basically to do something illegal. And I said no, which is all cool. But then I thought later on, you know, my reaction to that was kind of interesting. I admit that I didn't consider the fact she had asked me to do something criminal. I guess in thinking back on it, I figured I must have thought that was just some way that she managed to manage this household of, you know, a lot of folks who were incompetent to handle their own business affairs, and I thought nothing more of it. Of course, after she was arrested and charged, I thought, whoa, that was kind of what she was doing that whole time. I wrote about that in the first book. Nothing ever came of it. It was just, in fact, I don't know how the defense would have handled that, or the prosecution even. It wasn't that important. All said, her trial after my book, well, it lasted a year. The jury deliberated for a month.
It lasted a year? The trial lasted a year.
363 days.
Wow.
That was amazing. Well, it was an entirely circumstantial case. And, in fact, yesterday I gave a talk to a Sacramento a book club. About 60 people were there. And during that, one of the people who was there was actually one of the court clerks during her entire trial, during the entire year, where everybody in Sacramento moved down to Monterey for the year for this trial. So it was very complicated. And as I learned just yesterday, there was one juror out of the 12 who held out to the bitter end, and that's why they deliberated for a month. This guy wouldn't move. He thought Dorothea was innocent. But finally, I guess he caved. I don't know. Maybe they told him they're going to cut off their hotel bill, or I don't know. Anyway, he changed his vote finally, and she was convicted. She was convicted of 3 of the murders. There were 9 bodies discovered. One of them off property, and there was suspicion that there were others that just hadn't, you know, been missed. And I might add here, the only reason she got caught was she finally let somebody into the home who was being watched by outside people, in this case, 2 social workers who placed a man named Bert in the household. And then when Bert disappeared, they were not satisfied with Dorothea's explanation of where Bert went. Bert was essentially incompetent to do the sort of things they said he was doing. And then they said he went to Shreveport, Utah, to visit relatives. Well, A, he had no relatives, and B, there is no Shreveport, Utah. So the social workers thought there was something very suspicious. And that's kind of where it all started unfolding.
But they found nine bodies. How did they not think? Why were the nine bodies not circumstantial? That doesn't make sense to me.
Cause of death. Many of the bodies were really decomposed. Very difficult to determine anybody's cause of death because the theory was, and the jury accepted it at the end, the theory was that Dorothea, in addition to getting money from, you know, as co-payee, she was also handling all of these folks' prescriptions. They were all older people. They were all on some sort of drug prescription. And those that she wanted to exploit, theory was, for example, if they're taking a powerful drug of some sort, say, once a day, she would withhold those for 3-4 days and then give them a bunch to take. And then they would die. The theory is that the very first person that she died and was buried probably died of some sort of natural circumstances. But since Dorothea was, as I said, had a record, she wasn't about to call the police and have them come out and deal with this natural death because it would soon become apparent that Dorothea did not actually have a license to be doing what she was doing. She wanted to hide that fact. So I always thought, and I think people that I talked to involved agreed that probably the first death was accidental. And her problem was trying to make sure that the cops, nobody asked her where her license was, and then she would be in big trouble too. And then maybe she realized how easy it was.
Dan, we're going to take a break, a word from our sponsors, and be back with more learning about Dorothy Fuentes. This is fascinating.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL is brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
I'm Liz Klayman, and this is the Fox Business Report.
A choppy trading session with the major averages ending higher following a softer-than-expected wholesale inflation reading for June, which followed Tuesday's cool consumer price index report. The Magnificent Seven big-cap tech stocks were mostly higher. Shares of Apple rose 4% and hitting an all-time high. Its artificial intelligence system has secured government approval in China. Software stocks also advanced. High-flyer memory and storage stocks like Micron Technology and SanDisk sank as the overall chip sector gave back some of the previous session gains. Shares of IBM fell nearly 3% after tanking 25% on Tuesday. The Dow winners, Apple, Alphabet, and Goldman Sachs. The Dow decliners, Caterpillar, Travelers, and United Health Group. The Dow rising 150 points, the Nasdaq higher by 162, S&P 500 up 29. That's your Fox Business Report. I'm Hillary Barsky, invested in you.
My name is Whitney Allen, and I'm a widow. My husband Ryan died. We never thought we'd ever have to use life insurance, but the unexpected happened. With Ethos, signing up was fast and 100% online. You can get a quote in seconds, apply in minutes, and get same-day coverage. No medical exams, and you can get up to $3 million worth of coverage. I'm grateful we were prepared.
Get your free quote at ethos.com/term. That's ethos.com/term. Paid spokesperson. Time spent on application may vary. Online health questions required.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
Junior, you know why my TV is turned down so low? Last week, I went down to see Peter Lussier at Hearing Aid Specialists of the Central Coast. He's a nice young feller who tested my hearing. He had me try on these nearly invisible hearing aids. See? They ain't got no buttons or nothing. By gum, I hear like I'm 29 years old. Call Peter at Hearing Aid Specialists. Dial 805-460-7385. Or use your smartphone and go to slowcountyhearingaids.com.
Have you felt that instant panic when your car breaks down? You deserve to be treated like a guest, not a problem. At Shiftin' Gears Auto Repair, they're shiftin' expectations with hospitality-geared auto service. Transparent updates, honest answers. They have your back from the moment you call, and they are always ready to serve you. Next. Finally, auto repair that puts you first.
The Sound Off lines are open at 238-5775. 238-KPRL. The North County's listening to you on Sound Off.
Welcome back to Sound Off. My name is Karen Veely, your host on Wednesday and Thursday afternoon. Today I have Dan Blackburn on the show, co-founder of Calcoast News and best-selling author of Human Harvest, a story about serial killer Dorothy Puentes. And Dan, so the argument was that these were accidental deaths and she just disposed of the bodies while collecting their money. Am I correct on that?
No, she never discussed. I'm getting feedback. Are you?
No.
At any rate, no. Ask me that again, please.
So, what was her argument? So she claims, the idea was that these people died naturally, and she just buried them in the backyard. Did she continue collecting their Social Security money at that point?
Yeah, thanks. No, she never admitted her guilt. She went to her death basically claiming her innocence. It was a circumstantial case, but the question, of course, was, is she the one who was responsible for killing these people and planting them in her yard? It seemed like the obvious answer was yes, but there was no proof per se, and that's why the case became one of a presentation of circumstantial evidence, and it was a circumstantial case from start to finish. And there were many, many elements of the case that were unbelievable, particularly for that one person on the jury that I mentioned just earlier. The fact that she could conscript so many individuals to help her do things without any of them suspecting what they were doing. She would have a body wrapped after a death, body wrapped in a carpet, for example. And then she would ask one of the persons in the house who had, limited mental capacity, and probably during the middle of the night, to help her move this carpet downstairs. And, of course, the helper would think nothing of it. He would carry it with her downstairs and drop it down, and then he would go back to bed. In the meantime, before that, she would have had somebody dig a trench or something for some gardening effort in the backyard. And again, these were people who didn't really have critical thinking. They couldn't say, oh boy, there's something going on here. They would just do what they were told because they were getting a place to sleep. Everything was, good. She had great food. Who could complain? So generally speaking, that was kind of how. So, of course, during trial, who helped her? Well, they could only identify one or two people from the house, former tenants, who actually helped. One of them was a pretty sharp guy. First name was John. I don't remember his last name. But he was pretty sharp, and he had helped. And the prosecution was absolutely certain that he was a co-conspirator. But he was never charged, again, because there was no real evidence other than he may have at some point, unprovably maybe, helped carry a body downstairs. A smart man must have known what was going on, et cetera, et cetera. So as clear as it all seemed to be to the casual observer, the trial made it out to be extremely complicated. But in the end, what was she but just a con man, a con lady? She was a con. She knew how the system worked. She knew how to milk it. And she was always one step or more outside the law. Now, that was Dorothea. And yet she looked exactly the opposite of that. She looked like everybody's grandma. She spoke in a soft, kindly way. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure she got angry at people, but I had never heard of her having an outburst of any sort, either during her trial or times I've talked to her, a real anger outburst. You know, she was capable of blending in and being remarkable only when somebody was interested in Social Security benefits. So she really had a small group of enthusiastic supporters, but they were all benefiting from her expertise. And they were telling their friends, their elderly friends, that Dorothea was pretty smart at this, too. So she had a real racket going. And again, it had to do with lack of money by the city to do much in the way of what she was doing. So the city was depending, and probably still is, a lot on voluntary help in the arena of taking care of people who are essentially incapable of handling, you know, themselves, their life, day-to-day living.
Over how many years had these people died? How many? There were 9 bodies, but how? What were the span of years?
Well, they could only really determine that by trying to figure out the order, or the rough order anyway, of the bodies being buried, part of which was available through, you know, a decomposition progress, other elements, things that might have been found on the body that might identify when things happened. But to answer your question, probably a period of 9 to 10 years. So she got away with it a lot. I mean, and it wasn't like she was planting one every other week. And again, these were people who had essentially lost contact with their families one way or the other. They were either alcoholics or drug addicts or just, you know, having emotional issues that families couldn't deal with. You know, there was just nobody, if they disappeared, there was nobody to know or to care that they had disappeared. So that's how she worked until Bert came along and she made a mistake.
And so they in the end, they did find her to be guilty. But you were also, after a year-long trial, it's very interesting, so she is found guilty. What was she sentenced for?
Well, she was sentenced, actually convicted of 3 of the murders. Those are the ones that the prosecution had most compelling evidence. So there were a number, goes between 5 and 8, or 5 and 6 probably, of bodies that were discovered where there was no real resolution. But she was convicted of 3 murders and sentenced to life in prison. So and the district attorney took the death penalty off pretty early on in the game, probably before the trial even started. I'm sure that happened. The reason for that was her, you know, her persona, her public appearance, probably wouldn't have been a good thing to execute her, particularly in the view of the fact she was, I think at that time, probably in mid-70s. Let's see, it was longer away than that. So she died in 2011. Anyway, she was elderly, and the state didn't see any reason to execute an elderly woman. So she was sentenced to life, and she died in 2011. Interesting, because the cause of death was described, at least by the coroner, as natural causes due to age. She always said that she had cancer primarily of the jaw, and she talked about having been one of the victims in the March of Bataan. You might remember the Japanese marching American prisoners, and she had all these crazy stories that she could spin together, and I suppose it never occurred to anybody that it was important enough to check on, but it was all BS. She had her own stories that she would tell people depending on who they were and what they needed to hear. But I understand that while she was in prison, it was determined she had no cancer anywhere. So that was all a sympathy thing, which she did a lot. You know, she asked people to consider how hard a life she had and all the problems she had as a, you know, as a younger woman. Just a woman who needed a lot of support, and she got it until it was all over, and she no longer had that support.
And so she was, after she was convicted, she did send you around this period of time when you were writing. She sent you an email, correct?
Well, no, we actually communicated by letter on a number of occasions. She would write talking about something that happened. For example, there was a writer who decided to do some sort of a cookbook with Dorothea. He got some publicity because it was rather odd, seeing as his Dorothea was kind of convicted about manipulation of drugs to kill. So, you know, there was an irony to all that. But essentially, I think I probably got 3 or 4 letters during the interim period. I thought the last letter that I got was particularly interesting. I still have it. She said, "Dear Dan," she was very polite, "Dear Dan, I have read every single word you've ever written about me. I did not like any of it. Sincerely, Dorothea."
She was polite.
She was very polite. In fact, that's the most polite I've ever been criticized as a reporter. So, that's fun. So, you know, that's the story of the adventure, and I don't know, you got any questions? You want to add anything? I could talk about this thing forever because it was, to me, in my life, mondo bizarro. And I might add, all of this occurred because, you know, I hit a stroke of luck. The only thing I did involve, you know, to get involved in the whole thing, I think, was probably send her that letter to the Sacramento City Jail when she was being transported from L.A. Because after that, everything was just kind of lucky. It just kind of fell into place. Like, this new publisher knew about the Dorothea case, so as soon as I mentioned it, there was interest immediately. All kinds of, you know, luck. My wife discovering that little ad in Variety magazine or Variety newspaper that you know, triggered the whole thing. You know, it was lucky, but I imagine Dorothea probably would have tried to single out some reporter. That was her shtick. She needed somebody advocating for her other than her lawyer because, you know, of course, lawyers don't say too much pending, you know, free trial.
Hey, Dan, I have a text message for you.
Okay.
Somebody wants to know, how can someone meet you? How do you meet Dan? Do you think you're going to do another book tour?
It depends on what this new publisher is going to do, and I don't have the details of what he wants. I have an agreement from him, but it doesn't reflect exactly what is going to occur. I think it's a reprint of the paperback, which was the update after Social Security issues had been resolved by Congress. But if somebody wants to contact me, I don't mind giving my email address. Shall I do that?
Yes.
I'll just do it on the air. It's Blackburn, BLACKBURN, DanielJ@gmail.com. And I'll try to respond to anybody that writes.
When does the HBO series, when is it going to be published?
I don't think they've made that notification yet. We're actually still trying to find out what level they're at in terms of, you know, the writing of the script and how many shows they're going to be put on. I'm thinking they don't have that too far along because they've announced this as a limited series. And I think if they had a number of programs set, they'd probably say a 6-part series. So, I don't know. It's just the answer is I don't know. A lot will probably be coming out now because from what I hear, Gina Davis is, you know, pretty hot at this moment. I don't know too much about her. But so, you know, we'll see what happens with that.
I really like Gina Davis, and I've liked some of her movies very much. I think she's a very good actress. We're going to take a break, a word from our sponsors, and we'll be back with one more segment with Dan Blackburn.
Listen to this real Paso Robles Glass customer where they installed 23 replacement Milgard Tuscany windows and two sliding doors.
Steve Eklund, Craig Smith as an architect and a proud and honored client of Paso Robles Glass. Hey, the boys are doing a great job. They just left. Everything is just fine. Extremely good crew. You got that crew is exceptional. They're all hardworking guys, very careful, very cautious. All is good. I think they have one more day tomorrow, wrap it up, the finished work. I'd like to set up a time to come up and see you next week. I've got a big, big project I'd like you to look at for me. Whatever works on your end, just wanted to let you know, Steve. Take care. Bye.
Get rid of your old broken windows and get new Milgard energy-efficient windows and doors with Milgard's ironclad lifetime warranty.
This summer, fuel up your fun at Tachi Palace Casino Resort with Summer Cash and Gas. Every Thursday in July and August, Premier Club members can score cash and prizes with four winners every hour. And on August 20th and 27th, our 8 p.m. winner can skip the pump by riding away with a brand new custom e-bike plus $5,000 cash. Get in, get playing, and get ready to win. Summer Cash and Gas, only at Tachi Palace Casino Resort in Lemoore.
When it comes to sustainable energy systems and service, Central Coast residents trust Solarponics. Marilyn from Templeton says, quote, Solarponics installed our system almost 20 years ago. There are occasions when your system needs to be serviced. With Solarponics, work is completed quickly with knowledge and skill. This is as important a part of a solar company as the original installation. Thank you, Marilyn, for your Google review. When we install a sustainable energy system, we're installing a lifetime of as important service. Don't just go solar, go Solarponics. Solarponics.com.
Attention Central Coast homeowners. Is your water heater over 7 years old? If so, replace it with a heat pump water heater before it fails and save thousands in energy costs. Plus, new rebates cover up to 80% of the cost. Call or click to get a free, no-hassle quote today. Don't just go solar, go Solarponics. Solarponics.com.
Central Coast Tractor Work, with decades of construction and earthwork experience. They are the go-to outfit for all your home, farm, and ranch excavation needs. They do site prep, excavation, grading, trenching, utility work, demolition. They even do brush removal and lots more. They handle it all, and no job is too small. Call them today and get your project moving. And by the way, they work weekends. Central Coast Tractor Work, 805-440-6361.
Welcome back to Sound Off. My name is Karen Vealey, your host on Wednesday and Thursday afternoon. Today I have Daniel Blackburn, the co-founder of Cal Coast News, on the show. We are talking about his book, Human Harvest. It was a story of a serial killer in Sacramento. He wrote it about 36 years ago, and it's being brought back out right now by Simon & Schuster. They're going to republish his book. I saw someone was trying to call in. I couldn't get to that during the break. But if you want to call and ask Dan a question, it's 805-238-5775. 805-238-5775. Dan, are you surprised at the current interest in this, in the story?
Oh, actually, I am. And let me correct something, please. Simon & Schuster has the distribution rights at the present time to my paperback book. I have a publisher, not not Simon & Schuster, who has worked with me in the past, who also, well, I have the rights to the book, essentially. So what we're doing now is he's going to, this is not my original publisher, but the one who took over and printed the paperback and has kept in touch with me, to do a reprint of the book. I have the rights to do that, so that's what the discussion is all about right now. So it will actually be available in a different form as soon as it's republished, and I'll let you know when that occurs, because I'm uncertain too. I don't know if he's going to change the cover or what, if I might have an opportunity to write a new foreword for it. I don't know. So anyway, a lot of information, a lot of this is just happening, and it's all happening because HBO finally has elevated this thing to a little beyond the one-hour format that it's been treated over the last number of years. But, you know, as we said in the news business, Dorothea's story has legs, and it has fascination to people, as I said, because it covers so many facets, the Social Security issue, the grandmotherly look to a hardcore criminal, all of the elements that people look for in the crime genre, which is a very popular publication genre. And she, as you said, she is one of America's rare female serial killers. There are one or two others, several that come to mind right away, but she's right up there with the number of them. So when you start talking about these very notable female serial killers, she's right there among them, because not only was she cold and cruel, she was also doing her crimes somewhat in the open. And if you saw her house, and there's a fence next to it, and then housing elsewhere right around it. In other words, higher housing right around her, apartment buildings, condos, and whatnot. Like, anybody could look down out of their window and see her entire backyard. So it was always a mysterious thing, and I think it probably remains that way, how she could do all that she did in her backyard, which was very small. I can't give dimensions of it, but it would be very a typical little plot for a old downtown area. So the mystery, of course, was how did she do it? And a lot of that came through, particularly in the administration of drugs. She handled all of their drugs, I think I said earlier, as well as their money. So she was able to manipulate things. I'd tell the story about, real quickly here, one of her tenants was on probation, and he had a drinking problem, but he was also one of her tenants. Since she had all the money, she would just distribute money to people when their checks came in, give them, $10, $20, $30, whatever they needed to spend. She'd always make sure that she gave him enough, $25, $30, so that he would head straight across the street to a bar called Joe's. And then Dorothea would call the police anonymously on a tip line that a guy who was on probation and not supposed to be drinking alcohol was drunk in a bar called Joe's, and he's causing a lot of trouble. And the cops would respond. They'd look around, see who's on probation. They'd find him, take him in. He'd spend 6 months or so in the slammer. Dorothea would continue to get his checks. When he gets out of local jail, certainly doesn't occur to him to figure out where his check is. He's kind of on the lam. Dorothea continues to collect checks until there's some sort of stoppage. But nobody ever asks why she was collecting so many of these, after people had disappeared, until after the fact. So she was cunning. She was attractive. And I suppose that combination made her a very dangerous woman.
You know, I loved your book, but it didn't go into the trial and what happened. It would be nice if the new copy goes into the things that happened afterwards. And then, how she died.
If I have that option, I know. In fact, I'm in the midst of preparing communication with the publisher to find out exactly what he's got in mind and how much influence I might have over the new content. If he ends up wanting to just reprint the book, the paperback, I guess, you know, I'm cool with that. Do nothing and maybe get paid something, who knows. But I'll keep you posted on that, Karen. I know you're interested in it, and I am too. These are deals that I've, you know, never really dealt with, even though I'm an old guy. Yeah, so this is all fun, interesting, and I'll keep you informed as it unfolds.
And I sent you a graph last night. I was telling you that serial killers went up by decade. So there is a university group that has tracked serial killers every decade in the U.S. since like the 1900s. And back then you had like, you know, you had around 30 serial killers up to about 80 every decade until you get through and you start the 60s and the number goes up to 200. And then they continue to climb until the 1980s, and in 10 years, they had over 768, so they had 768 serial killers, and then it went down just about as fast as it went up, and since the 2010s, we had about 100 serial killers. So it is very interesting. There was a period of time back then when there were a lot more serial killers than there are now.
Well, they were probably acting on their own knowledge that criminal detection techniques weren't all that sophisticated. And I would bet that when serial killers who were smart enough to understand the writing on the wall, when they started hearing about DNA and all that sort of stuff, how easy it was for investigators to figure out who done it, some of them might have been deterred. The problem, I guess, is somebody kills somebody and gets away with it. From what I understand, they look at killing a little bit differently. So I don't know. You know, who knows what's in the mind of a serial killer? I can't stand to hear myself cry, much less a victim. So I just can't imagine how somebody could do those things to people. And I guess that's the fascination. We're all, as decent human beings, wondering how these monsters can exist among us and do the things they do to people. And that's, I guess, the root of the fascination with people like Dorothea. You know, there are people who kill because they're in a fight or they're fighting with somebody, you know, some sort of domestic disturbance or neighborhood dispute. That kind of, serial killers are a whole different kind of thing. That's somebody who has actually killed somebody, gotten some sort of gratification out of it, and decided to do it again. And as they proceed, they theoretically get a little smarter about how to do things, which, of course, elevates their confidence in getting away with it. I don't think any serial killer does it hoping to get caught. I think they all believe in their psychotic way that they will be different, they can do what they want to, and nobody will ever catch them. But again, the ones that are smart enough to think like that are probably also smart enough to say, I'll probably screw up with my first killing and they'll catch me. So that could well be a deterrent, you know, the idea of technology. Who knows?
And Dan, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show today. I know that people can still get Human Harvest from Amazon, but I am hoping that they do let you go and put another chapter in there talking about the trial and what happened, and that we can have an update on this in the future. But absolutely. Thank you very much for coming on.
Enjoyed it greatly. Thanks for the invite.
This hour of Sound Off on KPRL was brought to you by Lind Patrol, specializing in dryer vent cleaning. Don't overwork your dryer or let your vent start a fire. Contact Dylan at lindpatrolca.com or call 805-975-5176.
AM 1230 KPRL, 99.3 FM, KPRL.com, Paso Robles, Atascadero, Templeton.
It's 2 o'clock.